A couple of months ago, I was asked to at least consider presenting a lesson on the topic that you can see on the screen, the idea of physical health and how that relates to our Christianity. And I hesitated for a couple of reasons. One of those was actually, what do I say about that? Is there anything in the Bible to say about that? So it was first of all, a study I needed to do, and then secondly, how would it be presented? But perhaps the main reason I can identify by an experience I had a couple of weeks ago. The kids at school, some of the kids had prepared this big breakfast for the faculty and invited us all to come, which I did, along with my wife Pam, and we were going down the line, and one of the kids, most likely one of the kids' mothers, had prepared a particular dish for this breakfast, one of which, when you smelled it, 2 or 3 pounds were automatically added. And as Oscar Wilde once said, I can resist anything but temptation. And so, you know, here it is in front of me, and not to hurt anybody's feelings, I took a piece and kind of vocalizing what was going on in my head, I said out loud, well, there goes that 20 minutes on the rower this morning. Well, a woman overheard me say that. And she kind of jokingly said a couple of things to me, but then she continued on. And she said, well, I can exercise. I've got kids, and mothers of young kids can't exercise. And then suddenly it changed and said, well, somebody's got to earn a living, and I've got to get up early to earn a living. And so, you know, I'm kind of perplexed by all of this and wishing I hadn't thought out loud at the moment. And then realized what was happening. She wasn't arguing with me. She was arguing with herself. These were the things that had been going on in her mind, and kind of like I had vocalized a thought, her thoughts were being vocalized as well. And I suppose if I had to give a reason for dallying on presenting this sermon, it is because a topic like this is rather sensitive. And oftentimes, things of this nature can come across judgmental. And I say at the outset, this is a completely no-judgment sermon. I understand that problems with weight and the ability to exercise can be quite legitimate. And sometimes there's medical reasons for that, and sometimes there's difficulties with it. And so I do not present this to cause anyone to think that I'm coming down hard on one particular person or the other. But like anything that I present from the pulpit, it's because it's in the Bible. And so this evening, I'd like to explore some of these thoughts with you as we think about what God has told us about this concept of physical health and our physical bodies and how that relates to the spiritual choices that we make. Now, you know what typically comes first, right, in a discussion like it, so let's just go ahead and get that out of the way. And that's the concept of gluttony. Whenever we talk about these things from the Bible, one of the first things people will think about or talk about is the idea of being a glutton. And perhaps this is either a really good time or really bad time after celebrating a holiday that's known about eating to talk about this. One morning I had a news show on and I heard the man say something about, well, this is the week of gluttony. And I realized he had no idea how that term is supposed to be used, at least in a biblical sense. So let's begin, first of all, by looking at how God uses this term. It's not used very often, but yet there is a very consistent pattern when the term gluttony is used. Let's just take a look at that in the verses that we find. The first is in Deuteronomy 21, as the law is being discussed here about a rebellious son. What to do about him. And if it gets bad enough, he's to be stoned. And so Moses says this, they shall say to the elders of the city, this is his parents bringing the charge, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. All right, keep that thought in mind. We move on to the book of Proverbs, where in chapter 23, the thought is repeated in verses 20 and 21. Where Solomon says, be not among drunkards or among gluttonous eaters of meat. For the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and slumber will clothe them with rags. And then we look to Matthew and Luke that's giving us the same account here. The words of Jesus when he says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they said, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, yet wisdom is justified by her deeds. Now, if you'll look at these verses, note that every time we read glutton, we read drunkard. They're always parallel in these thoughts. And I came across someone who said, I believe quite correctly, that drunkenness is liquid gluttony. Right? That's right, isn't it? All right, now keep those thoughts in mind. Two other occasions we find the term used not associated with drunkenness. One of those we find again in the book of Proverbs, where we read this, the one who keeps the law is a son with understanding, but a companion of gluttons shames his father. And then one other is where the Apostle Paul refers to the Cretans in this way, when he says, one of the Cretans, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. All right, so the first four or five passages we find, it's drunkards and gluttons, then a companion of gluttons, then lazy gluttons. What's God telling us by this? Well, he's telling us that this is not an isolated incident, that if you overate Thursday at your Thanksgiving dinner, that does not make you a glutton. The idea of gluttony is a lifestyle. It's someone who is doing something in excess on a very regular basis. Just as we find the idea of here's a drunkard who's always overdoing it with liquor, here's somebody, in this case, who's overdoing it with food. But let me put a quote up here that I think helps us with this. A man by the name of Chris Donato gets credit for this. He says, two mistakes accompany most discussions on gluttony. The first is that it pertains only to those with a less than shapely waistline. The second is that it always involves food. In reality, it can apply to toys, television, entertainment, sex, or relationships. It's about an excess of anything. Let's illustrate that. How many times do we hear, and perhaps even say, I spent the entire weekend binge watching. You heard that? That's a fairly common thing now. And sometimes I'll hear people say, I binge watch 5 seasons of this show in one weekend. Well, that's gluttony, isn't it? Here is the excess of something. Something that maybe on its own would be okay, but here it is in excess. And that's what this man is saying, that while we oftentimes think about this with food, which it does apply, and we'll continue that thought here in a minute, it's a mistake to say that gluttony is only involved in food. It's whenever we're trying to, or succeeding perhaps, in doing something in an excessive way to gain some kind of satisfaction by that. All right, so let's return then to the discussion on the aspect of food. And let's think about this from really the perspective. When you think about a lifestyle choice of what we eat, there's two ends of the spectrum here. On one end, we've got asceticism. On the other end, gluttony. Asceticism is just a fancy way of saying, here is someone who thinks that the deprivation of something to the body makes them more holy, makes them more religious or spiritual. And we find warning against that within the Word of God, Colossians chapter 2. The Apostle Paul says, these indeed have an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. So here's some person who says, well, if you really want to be holy, you really want to be spiritual, then you do this, or you stay away from this and you deprive yourself of this. Now go to the other end. On the other end is gluttony, again, of which we're warned by the apostle, this time Philippians 3, where he says, their end is destruction, their God is their belly. Their God is their belly. In other words, here is the satisfaction. This is what's trying to be pleased. So, upon this spectrum, we've got lots of different varieties of people. Let's go to the side of asceticism. Here is someone who is a health fanatic in every sense of the term. Someone who would look at you and say, well, if you're not eating kale chips, you know, you're not really the kind of person you need to be. If you're putting in any of these things that I consider to be bad, well, that's saying something about you. You obviously are not a terribly righteous person. Or maybe it's somebody who spends hours and hours at the gym, but really gives no concern to development spiritually, to working out spiritually. Well, now go to the other end. And so if on one end we've got the health fanatic, maybe on the other end we've got the unhealth fanatic. Here is the one who's never doing anything to take care of the body. Here is one who is taking in whatever he or she desires. Well, I want to make this point that whichever end of the spectrum we're on, the body has become the idol. Someone on the side of asceticism is saying, okay, I'm going to gauge my spirituality perhaps by how well I treat my body. On the other end, here's someone saying, I'm going to give my body whatever it wants. The God is my belly, as Paul would say. Both of those are wrong. Both of those are a form of idolatry. So where then does the Christian fit in? Well, in this, it would be with the idea of moderation. Someone who is not trying to spend an entire life staying in a gym or depriving the body simply to feel better about himself spiritually. On the other end, not someone who is eating anything that comes along and never taking care of the body, but instead, as in most things, moderation would be the answer. So what does that mean for us as we seek to develop the kind of lifestyle that would show that moderation? Well, that means we've got to maintain some great caution in our society. Because in American culture, there is a very much a tendency that promotes gluttony. Let's broaden that back out for a minute. Whether that be binge-watching TV shows or athletic events that we go to or television that we watch as far as sports go, whatever, there's a real tendency toward that. But there's also a great tendency toward promoting gluttony in the sense of food. I must show you something. I could not have asked for a better illustration of this. As I was preparing for this lesson, I was reading several things online and came across an article, and I don't know how well you'll be able to see this, but I'll explain what's going on. I was reading this article, then part of it, what then is the solution to gluttony? And the advertisement that came up on its own was a sweatshirt that looked like a giant piece of uncooked beef. Now, could you ask for anything that illustrated that better? Well, here, just quite by random, I'm reading an article on don't be a glutton, and some company is saying, don't you want to look like a giant uncooked steak? You know, here's the idea. So what that is showing then is that food advertisements permeate our lives. I don't know if we realize that. You turn on the television, how many times are you seeing a restaurant advertised or some product you can buy online advertised or some grocery store that's having a sale? And even on your phones, if you ever get an app, what are they doing? If it's a food place, they're sending you the specials, the deals. So there's that great kind of perhaps unacknowledged force that's in our lives that's promoting us to go into a direction that maybe we really don't need to go. I think this is illustrated even within our language, in the vernacular. Sometimes we'll hear people self-identify as foodies. Well, when you add that IES to most things of this nature, it means you're devoted to it. Means it's something that you give a lot of credence to. You give a lot of support for this. And, you know, someone says, oh, I'm a real foodie. Well, just exactly what are we saying? Those are the kinds of things where we've got to exercise some caution about how we think. And so our question is, well, if we've got this big promotion out there from our society that's kind of pushing us in this direction of taking in more than really we need to, how do we deal with that? Well, we deal with it like we deal with any problem of that nature. And that is, we exercise self-control. There's a reason that when the Apostle Paul is talking about the fruit of the Spirit, one of the things he listed is the ability to control ourselves. That our emotions or our desires or our tendencies, we don't put those in the driver's seat. We don't let them maintain control. It's the idea of keeping our intellect fully where it needs to be. Because then Paul talks about the works of the flesh. Let's notice that. Here in Galatians chapter 5, he says, "Now the works of the flesh are evident," and I skipped over a few of those, but look at the ones listed: envy, then drunkenness. But notice he doesn't stop there, because he adds, "and things like these." Now, if four or five of our uses of the word gluttony in the Bible are always in association with drunkenness, I don't think it's too much of a leap to say that's in a thing like these. That's something like what he's just described. And he says, look, I want to warn you as I did before of these things because they'll keep you out of the kingdom of heaven. That if I'm giving myself over to excess, I'm allowing my body to take control, I'm allowing it to be satisfied in whatever way, then what Paul is saying is you're getting really, really close, if not being there, with these things that I've just listed to you. So that means then that when it comes to spiritual choices and our physical body, that if we are binging on anything, including food, to a point that it's placing us at a wrong place in our lives, it's time for a change. It's time for us to deal with that as we would any of these other things. Now, let me kind of change gears here a bit. Something else that I think would be applicable as we consider this topic are some of the descriptions that God uses for our bodies. Two of those, one perhaps more used than the other, helps us to see what God expects. In discussions of this nature, it's not uncommon to come to 1 Corinthians 6. The Apostle Paul here is talking about bewaring of sexual sins. Let's just read this passage together, beginning in verse 15. He says, "Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own." When we think about where this terminology of our body being a temple comes from, it takes us back to the Old Testament. That as we think about the temple there on the Mount in Jerusalem, that was a place where God and man were coming together. And so what we find in that then is that the concept of temple is picked up and it's used then throughout the Bible for various ideas. We've got, for example, Jesus saying, "Tear down this temple and I'll build it back in 3 days." And we've got the Apostle Paul and Peter calling the church the temple. And we've got Paul here telling the Corinthians, "Your body is a temple." Well, in all of these examples, we come back to this idea that the temple is a meeting place of God and man. So whether you take the Holy Spirit indwelling in you literally, or you take that to be a figurative description, at this point it really doesn't matter, because what's going on is that this is being shown to be the place where God and I are meeting, where we're coming together. Now, as we think about the original use of temple back in the Old Testament, this was a place where respect for God was to be very apparent. That when someone even looked on the temple, there was to be the idea here that this was a place that was set apart for God. It was a place that was not going to be defiled by the things of the world. And of course, we know from the laws that were given that if there was ever a time when people mistreated the temple, God took that very seriously. He took that as a point of great disrespect. So then what we oftentimes do, we'll draw on that analogy to say, well, we've got to take care of our bodies. And I know for years, as I've heard various men preach, maybe a point is made about smoking. And someone says, well, that smoking is damaging the temple. Goes to 1 Corinthians 6. Or someone who drinks, well, that alcohol is damaging the temple. Well, we would say the same thing here. That if those things are relevant points, which I think they are, we don't stop there. We don't end the discussion there and say, well, there's certain things that are in limits and certain things that are off limits. We take this point in its totality. We look at it together. Now, one thing that we oftentimes don't hear in this discussion is more of the comparison to a sacrifice, which I think makes the point even a little bit more clearly, especially as we look at Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, where the Apostle Paul says, I appeal to you, brothers, by the mercies of God. Then isn't this interesting? To present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Well, again, we go back to the Old Testament to see the beginning of this. And what we find in it is that God was very adamant, just as He was with the temple, about what was going to be sacrificed. And He said that a lack of concern over any offering was a disrespectful thing to Him. We look at passages such as in Malachi chapter 1, where God, in kind of exaggerated terms, is talking about the kind of sacrifices they were offering, and He says, take that to the governor. See what he would accept. The idea is, when you give a sacrifice to God, it's to be your very best. It's to be a recognition that here is something that in a sense I'm giving back to God, or I'm giving in replacement of myself. And so the apostle here says, when you think about your bodies, think about them as living sacrifices. So what we find then in this teaching, what he's saying is this body is really the vehicle of a transformed mind. And so if I'm giving my body as a living sacrifice to God, what that means that I've first done is I've made the intellectual commitment to Him, like we talked about last Sunday, with loving God with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our mind. So here is my body, and Paul says, you give that to God. That's now for His use. That's for His service. So that when you do that, it can be used to do His work. He can use you to accomplish His goals and His ways. So we take all of this together, and whether we're talking about our bodies being a temple or whether we're talking about our bodies being a sacrifice, it means that what I'm doing is I'm totally dedicating myself to His work. I'm giving myself fully to Him, that when I become a Christian, as we talked about even at the close of this morning's lesson where Gary brought out the passage about Christ living in us, I've given up myself to present myself to God. All right, so let's keep this idea of temple and sacrifice in mind, and let's take it to what I think is a pretty apparent conclusion with that. What those things are preparing us to be, what we're doing with this is becoming stewards of the Lord. When I give myself to God, what I'm saying is everything I am and everything I have, I want to use for your service. I want it to be for you. And so that means that we understand that every good thing in this life is on loan from God. We hear that a lot, don't we, at the collection. Somebody will say, well, the things we own, really we don't. They're from God. God has given them to us. Let's use them for His glory. I fully agree with that. I think that's the idea that we find in the Bible. Here's an illustration of that from Peter. When he's talking about these gifts, he says, as each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. So if God has given us something that's good, we use it in a good way to glorify Him, whether that be the funds that we take up on Sunday morning, whether that be the house I own, whether that be what I do for other people. I'm a steward of the blessings God has given. So what exactly does that mean? When I think about stewardship, what does that mean? Well, I went to a really scholarly source to get a definition here. This is from Wikipedia. Utilizing and managing all resources God provides for the glory of God and the betterment of His creation. I don't know that you could find a better definition than that. And then the passage is added, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. So that's the idea of stewardship. Here are all of these things that belong to God, and for a few years, I'm given custody of those things. God is saying, I'm putting those things in your charge for you to use, and I believe that would include as well the body that He gives us while we're here on earth. So what does that mean then? It means that if I am a good steward, I'm keeping my body in good working order for service to God. Let's consider this for a minute. What if you loaned your car to someone to do a job? Here's somebody who had to take something, transport it, whatever. And you say, take my car and use it. And you get the car back and it won't run. And you take it down to the mechanic and he says, well, you know you put diesel fuel in this when it's not a diesel engine. And you know where on the oil it says do not overfill was way overfilled. What would you say to that person? You'd say, you didn't take very good care of what I gave you to use. I wanted you to use this for my work and you didn't. Well, let's think about that from God's standpoint. If He's given me this vehicle that's going to do the work of my changed mind for His glory, that means I got to keep it in pretty good working order. I've got to keep it where I'm going to be able to glorify Him in the deeds that I do. What we must understand, though, that none of this is for vanity or for feelings of superiority. There are some people who would get the idea of keeping it in good working order really, really well because they spend all of this time exercising and all of this time at the gym and maybe all this time kind of obsessing over diet. But it's to look good. It's so that when people see them, they say, wow, that guy's really in shape. That woman's really in shape. Well, that's not a good motive. In fact, that would be a very bad motive because of vanity or any kind of feeling of superiority where I try to lord that over to over someone and say, well, you know, here, I've got it right and you don't. So it's never for that. It's for the glory of God. It's for the service that He gives. And so again, as we discussed last week, when that intellect is convicted, we're letting the soul, which is everything we do, and the might, the blessings that we have, all of that's working in unison together. Let me make one final point with this on stewardship. I think this also impacts our monetary stewardship. That as we think about these ideas that we're talking about this evening, we have to take the monetary aspect in. Because if there is any one thing on which Americans spend lavishly, it's healthcare. You ever thought about how many dollars we spend on that? I'm always amazed at the end of every year when I'm getting my information together for taxes to look at how much my family has spent on that. Why? Because for most of us, health care is an already made choice. We'll do whatever it takes to stay healthy. We'll go to the hospital if we need to. We'll find the best doctor we need to. It's one of the few things where a majority of the people truly say money is no object in keeping me healthy. Well, if that's the case, and I'm making poor choices in my lifestyle, that are leading to increased health cost, there's a bit of a problem there, isn't there? Because again, we look at other ideas that would cross on over into this lane, and we often make points about those, don't we? We think about materialism, the wasting of God's blessings. Here's somebody who again, perhaps is a glutton for things, And so every time one goes to the store, one comes home with bags full of stuff. Well, that's shopping gluttony. And I doubt there are many Christians who, at least on the surface anyway, would attest that that's okay. But what about the idea of where we're continuing to make choices that are adding to these medical bills every year? Well, we got to think about that. Is that really the best use of the resources that God has given to me? As far as physical body, as far as monetary things that I have. And so I think these are things that we consider also. So as we look at this in its entirety, what God is not telling us is that we've got to be on some so totally strict diet that everybody who looks at us just says, wow, that must be a really religious person. While on the other hand, God is definitely saying, you don't have the kind of lifestyle where it's not that you're eating to live, but rather you're living to eat. He says, no, you can't have that kind of lifestyle either. It's finding that moderation, that idea of self-control, to think about, here is something that God has given me to use in His service, and as a good steward, as a representative of this meeting place of God and man, as a living sacrifice, I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to use it to the best of my ability. So, with all of that said, ultimately, the body's going to wear out. It's going to die. No matter what we do, no matter how good we take care of this body, it's going to go. However, God also says, it's going to be raised again. That when that final judgment comes, spirit and body will come back together. God says, I'm going to prepare you for eternity. You'll have a body that will be certainly of eternal proportions. So then a new question emerges. Are we making good decisions about this immortal body? Because you see, what's been transformed is one day going to be assigned a place in eternity, where we will be forever. And so while it's necessary for us to talk about the physical, it's of extreme importance for us to talk about the spiritual side of this. To think about the decisions that we're making now that are going to impact us forever. Where are we going to be when God raises us up out of the tomb? Where we stand before Him in judgment? To which side will we be assigned? Well, this evening, if you're not a Christian and you understand what you need to do, now's the time to make that choice. It's time to say, I'm ready to become a child of His, to meet Him in the waters of baptism, where by His grace and your faith, your sins are going to be washed away. Or perhaps it's been choices that you've made that have led you in directions that mean that your soul is not secure for eternity. If you'd like for us to pray with you this evening about that, we'll do so as well. Whatever it takes to be right with Him, won't you come while we stand and sing together?